perfection of wisdom. Just quickly, we're going to go in it more detail tonight, but I'll just go through the weeks with you. Week one is about the kinds of refuge, according to the Madhyamika textbooks. What is refuge and what is going for refuge? It's a very important subject. It's what makes you a Buddhist. If you have refuge, you're a Buddhist. If you don't, you're not a Buddhist, period. That's like the confirmation of a Buddhist. And it's not the verbal refuge, it's the mental attitude of refuge. Week two is the wish for enlightenment. That's bodhicitta. And you will learn everything you wanted to know about it. It's a very, very detailed section about bodhicitta. We're going to be studying from a monastic textbook which has the most detailed treatment that exists on these subjects. Week three is what is nirvana? I think if I passed around a paper and everyone wrote down their idea of what nirvana is, I doubt that there would be one correct one. And you will learn what nirvana is. It's very interesting. And all the kinds of nirvana. And everything about nirvana. It's very, very beautiful. That is one of your goals. But maybe you don't know what it is. Okay. Week four. Proofs for emptiness. This is a very famous section called Chittadho. And these are the arguments that are given in support of the idea of emptiness. I think if you pass a paper around most Buddhist centers and ask them to give a good argument for emptiness, you might not get a good argument. But here you're going to have all the arguments that were given by Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Aryadeva. These are the classical arguments, because this is the Asian classics. Okay. Who is Maitreya? This is a favorite subject of mine, because this was my pre-Geshe debate. Was this? They hand out slips of paper with your debate on it, and that was my debate. You know, who is Maitreya? So that's one of my favorite subjects. It's a very holy subject, because it is, I think, the only place that I'm aware of in the open teachings of Buddhism where the secret teachings are justified, and the reason for the secret teachings and how they work is explained in terms of the open teachings. So that's to me very exciting when I found that. Week six is conclusion and final exam. The way that works, the old students know. The homework comes from what I've taught in class, except for that thing about a kalpa. This is where I forgot to explain something in class and I got like 20 phone calls. And then the quizzes come directly from the homework. I just go to the computer and chop off some of the questions. And then the final comes directly from the quizzes. So you know what to expect when you come to class. There's never any surprises on purpose. So the first subject we're going to cover tonight is refuge. Unzela? We're going to try to do this right. Okay. I'm not supposed to teach unless you ask. So first we do... you ready? Yeah. And then we do Mandala. So Tom is our Umze. Umze means chanting master. Somebody asked me if we could have some kind of a tune to it, but I'll bring you one next time.
For those of you who aren't familiar with it, I don't know if anyone is or isn't, but it's the first page in white with Tibetan writing on it in the book. And then we'll be doing the third page with Tibetan writing.
These are out of order, by the way. I had a very busy lady. We should put the mandal before the moa. Okay.
So make the third page with Tibetan writing. The second page.
Some people are right.
You try to remember why you're taking this class. The basic reason for mandal is to request a teaching. That's your formal request for teaching. Otherwise, I can't teach you. And then the third one is dedication, which is dedicating the good deed that you did to something higher. So go ahead.
Ready? And we'll do the first three times. And the second one we'll just do once.
Okay, subject of the second course is the perfection of wisdom. Okay. Perfection of wisdom. This, yeah? Too hot? Too hot? You could turn the thing off downstairs. Maybe John, you ought to do it. You know where it is? On the wall.
Wall here?
Yeah. Okay, perfection of wisdom was originally taught by the Buddha, all right, Shakyamuni. BC, okay? 2,500 years ago. In India. It's one group of the sutras that he taught. Alright? And those sutras... Sutra means any teaching of the Buddha, an open teaching of the Buddha, not a secret teaching of the Buddha. Okay? And he taught Prajnaparamita, 500 BC. He taught many, many books of it. He taught it for 50 years, 51 years. We don't have all those books. Mainly we have three left. There are not only three, but we normally refer to the main three. And those are called... Nisum. Okay. Say, Ge.
Ge.
Ding.
Do.
You guys don't have to learn the Tibetan. You're the English course. You're going to learn English and you're going to teach it to your students in English. And that's how Buddhism in America will spread in English. But anyway, I'd like you to get the seed in your mind for it. It's a holy language and it's good for you. Okay, Ge means basically long. Ding means middle. And Do means short. And Sum means three. Ge ding du sum. Ge ding du sum.
Sum means, I'm sorry.
Long means the longer sutra on the perfection of wisdom. And that has 100,000 verses. Okay. That's the long version. Okay. That's actually the shortest version in India, but the others are lost. Right? 100,000 verses. The middle length book about the perfection of wisdom, the middle one is 20,000 verses. We call it Nichi. And the short one is Getomba, which means 8,000 verses. We've put the second one and the third one in the computer already. And I was dying to know whether it was verses or lines. And I asked the computer last night. It took it about 3 hours. And it's interesting. It's lines. So it's not really verses. Everybody calls it the 8,000 verses, but I was a little suspicious because it seemed too short. And it's really just lines.
So they're not repeated in all the, the 8,000 and not in the 20,000.
No, not really. And they're surprising. They're not like philosophical literature. If you read them, they are some very wonderful descriptions of meditation and what certain people did to get wisdom. I think one of the most famous stories that I enjoy from them is the Bodhisattva who couldn't stop crying. He's called the Ever Weeping, Daksungu. And how he gained wisdom, you know, how he went to find his teacher, what he went through to find his teacher. He's crying not because of love of sentient beings, which is what you always think when you read his name. He's crying because he's trying to sell his arms and his legs in the market to get money to offer his teacher to learn the perfection of wisdom, and these demons block his voice. So he's screaming, but no one can hear him. And he's crying out of frustration. So that was what he was worth. That's what it was worth to him. You know, he didn't have any money. He was going to give up his... He wanted to sell the flesh on his arms to learn the perfection of wisdom. Something like that. So that's Gedin Dusum.
Is that a true story?
Of course. These are the three great books that we have left about the perfection of wisdom. They are in the Kangyu, they are in the Tibetan. They don't exist, all of them, in the Sanskrit anymore. Those were burned when the Muslims came to India around 800. So we don't have the original books except in Tibet. Gyanin Dusum. As is normal in Buddhism, then you have somebody in the Middle Ages making a commentary on that. And that is... Well, you know. Maitreya. Right. Maitreya is sometimes called the future Buddha. He's supposed to be the next Buddha who comes. We don't say there's just one Buddha. We say there are thousands. And he's the next one in this planet. He lives in a Buddha paradise. We can't see him. That some people say he's just a Bodhisattva. He's not a Buddha. And in fact, that's going to be the subject of our last class. There's a big fight about it. You see in when the Buddha taught in India, he had a student named Maitreya, and he was a Bodhisattva, or appeared to be a Bodhisattva. So there's a big debate about it. Anyway, Maitreya taught a book to a Sangha. A Sangha is a wonderful story about a Sangha. We spoke about it last weekend. There was a nun in India. We believe it was about 300 AD or 350 AD. So we believe that it's... We don't know. But Western scholars guess that he lived around 350 AD. His mother was a nun, which is a contradiction in terms. She was a very good nun, and she had a vision that if she married the king and if she had children, that child would be exceptional. Those children would be exceptional. So even though she had no desire to live a family life, she gave up her robes and she married the king. And they had two children. And one was Vasubandhu, who wrote the Abhidhamma Kosha, and the other was a Sangha, who wrote down the five of the most famous books in Buddhism. So between those two twins, you've got most of the course in a Buddhist monastery was written by one of those two, which is amazing. Okay, and they were like incredible.
I wrote down the name of
the other one?
Sibling.
The brother? Yeah. Can you see if I go lower?
Can you
kindly
say the name of the book that
Vasubandhu? Yeah, I think I spelled that right, but I better check it. He wrote the Abhidhamma, the main text for Abhidhamma. It's called the Abhidhamma Kosha, and that's the last subject that you will study. Asanga wrote down the subject, the book that you're studying now, which is has a long name. And I won't put it in Sanskrit, I'll put it in... It's called The Ornament of Realizations.
That's the book within Prajnaparamita?
Well, I'm going to explain it. This is this onion thing of Buddhist commentaries, okay? Onion skin. So you have the Buddha, 500 BC, speaking these three books. They weren't written down until much later. People memorized them as he taught, because people in the old days had better minds than we have, because we are corrupted, as you can see if you walk outside. Okay. The Buddha taught Gendin Dusam. He taught those three books about the perfection of wisdom. And then, we believe around 350 AD, but, you know, that's a Western scholar guess, and really Western scholars, we don't have any idea, actually, we just guess. I mean, it's pretty much guess. Maitreya taught this book to Asanga. He taught The Ornament of Realizations to Asanga. Okay. Western scholars say Asanga wrote it. Buddhists believe Asanga he was able to meet Maitreya directly, and Maitreya told him what to write. And if you memorize that book, which you are required to in the monastery, it's about 50 pages. It's incredible. And the last chapter, the eighth chapter, is what is a Buddha? And the verse, the beat changes, the rhythm changes, and you get this feeling that a Buddha wrote it. You know, it's very holy. So, you know, if you ever get the chance to memorize it, you'll see. Okay, so Maitreya, we believe Maitreya taught it to his Sangha. Yeah.
So the name of the commentary then is The Ornament of Realizations?
Yeah. So The Ornament of Realizations is a commentary on the original sutras, the original books of the Perfection of Wisdom, of which we have mainly these three. There are more. There are five or six. Everybody got it straight? So Buddha taught those three Gendin Dusam. By the way, the three are called... These, if you want a cheat and you want one name for all of them, Yum. They're called Yum.
Okay. Does that mean mono?
Yeah, you know Yab Yum, right? Yeah. Yab Yum means like holy husband and holy wife. Like a spiritual husband and a spiritual wife. Yum, so Yum means wife or mother. Okay. And we call it the original books taught by the Buddha about the perfection of wisdom are called the mother. Okay? They're called Yum. So if somebody asks you, what are you studying? You say, ah, Yum. Okay, I'm studying Yum. This is, by the way, you have to know a little bit Tibetan in case some Tibetan asks you what Michael Roach is teaching you. And this is called, we call this Gen. Okay, Ornament of Realizations is called Gen. Gen is the word in Tibetan for ornament. So these are thousands of pages. This is 50 pages. It's written in code. Yendu shiwa tsona kushinik in yashi chisin kayam. Dola pemra tsena mashinik in jiten dudu zeba kankana yame dame tuna namakuna nasa disin van yamu chandu seme tsoche sange kini yun lira chak salas. That's the opening lines. We'll talk about it. So it's a beautiful book. You can't understand it. It's code. It's written in code because it's easier to memorize. Okay? And then you learn the code from your teacher. And that's the way they teach Buddhism in monasteries. You memorize this book in a monastery before you're 12 years old. And then your teacher unlocks it for you. So we can't read it directly. We need a commentary on the commentary.
You refer it again, right?
We're going to use the commentary by... Haribhadra. Haribhadra. By the way, this is the only historical part I'll ever teach you, so don't get too bored. But it's kind of frustrating. In a monastery, they don't explain much of this to you. He lived about 850 AD.
He was Indian?
Yeah. He wrote in Sanskrit. He's Indian. His name means pure lion.
Pure lion?
Yeah. And he wrote a book called... He wrote a couple of books, I mean, long. But he wrote a short commentary on the ornament, called The Clarification. That book is too hard for us to study. I promise you. So we need a commentary on that. We're running out of space. And the great Tibetan commentaries were written by Tsongkhapa and his students around 1400. I'm not going to write that down because we're not even going to study those because those are too hard. I'm not kidding. Okay, we spend 18 years on Gyaltsub Jay's commentary, for example, on logic, and we never reach halfway through the book. Okay? So you can't study Tsongkhapa direct. You would have trouble to study Tsongkhapa's explanation. It's about 1,000 pages. So we'll skip right to Kirup Dhamma Dhamma.
That's the commentary?
That's the commentary on the commentary on the commentary on the commentary to the Buddha's speech.
And who wrote that?
Oh, no, that's his name.
Oh, that's, okay.
That's the author.
Commenting on the clarification?
He's commenting on the clarification and on Tsongkhapa. But mostly on the clarification. We know his dates. He was born the year after Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Okay.
Which text is Tsongkhapa?
It's called Namshe Nyingbo Gyan, and I'm not going to write it because I don't want to overload you. You're not responsible to know that. He's from the greatest Buddhist monastery of all time, Sarimé. Right? Not Sarajevo. And I said that to a monk from Sarajevo recently, and he said, oh yes, he had a great teacher, because his teacher was from Sarajevo. So he's from my monastery. It's one of the six great monasteries in Tibet. There's three great monasteries according to Westerners, but really they're all split into two monasteries, and we compete with each other. And he wrote the textbooks that we study the perfection of wisdom from. We study it for 12 years in the monastery. You're going to study it for about a year and a half. And he wrote a book. We're going to study a book called the. He wrote a book called The Analysis of the Perfection of Wisdom. Okay. And I took that book and I chopped out the easy parts for you guys. What do I mean? I mean, Gelugpa's, my tradition in Tibet, we are accused of being too scholastic, you know, too dry, too boring. Don't meditate enough. And we just debate about small points. I'll tell you, it doesn't fit everyone. Some people don't want to know all this stuff and don't need to know all this stuff. They don't have the patience or the aptitude for it. This book was taught for a sangha. This book was supposed to be read only by high-level bodhisattvas. It was meant only to be read by great saints. So we're just kind of peeking at it. The intended audience for that book, and it says it at the beginning of the book, is people who are already on a very, very high level.
Which book?
The Abhisamma Angkhara, The Ornament of Realizations. All of these books are very difficult because they are teaching what mainly?
Logic.
Emptiness. Okay, they're teaching emptiness. They are very difficult. The Buddha didn't even teach emptiness to many of his disciples. He didn't touch emptiness his whole first round of teachings that he gave in his life. He did not mention emptiness. He did not get into emptiness because people couldn't understand it. In fact, he didn't even want to teach at all. I think it's 6 weeks or 8 weeks he stayed in the forest. He didn't want to talk to anybody. It's difficult. It's difficult. It takes some time and it takes some thinking. And it takes some training. And if you don't do it, you can go into meditation and get some explanation from somebody. And I would say probably you will not understand emptiness. I can say with some certainty that you will not perceive emptiness. And then you can't escape suffering. It's the only method to escape suffering. It's the only real method. Okay. There are other methods to get out of pain in the short term, you know, do good deeds, love other people, you know, as much as you can. And that's true. It will prevent you from hurting. But if you want to permanently stop suffering, you must understand this subject. It's the only method that can get you to what you would call paradise or the end of your suffering. So it's difficult, but if you take the time to learn it, then when you go into meditation, and you have all this stuff in your head, and you don't have to bring a book with you, you will see some incredible things happen. You will truly understand emptiness, and then if that happens to you, within the same half hour, as you perceive emptiness directly in meditation, you meet Buddha. You meet the Buddha directly. You perceive the Four Noble Truths, which means you perceive your past lives directly in meditation. You know that you have had a past life. You perceive your future, and you know how many lives it will take you to be out of this kind of life. You know, like you can say, okay, 7 more lives, I know. I will not suffer during those 7 lives. I will live in a high family. I will have all the money I need. And at the end of those 7 lives, I will finish all my suffering. I cannot stay in this kind of existence more than 7 more lives. Okay? Like that. I mean, right now you don't even know if you have a future life. You just sort of have a feeling about it. You perceive all these things directly. A very important thing that happens to you at that moment is that you see that you're not crazy. You know you're right. You know you're not hallucinating. And you can reach this point. You can reach this stage. You can see these things. You will see these things. But you need some training. You cannot do it without training. According to Buddhism, you've been here a few million years without training. Okay. It will not happen without training. And if you are fortunate, and if you are virtuous, you can see these things, and you will see these things. And then there's no... What do you care about anything if you know you're going to live 7 more lives? And you know what's going to happen in those lives. So what do you care? Who can tell you anything? You know, who can convince you of anything else if you saw them? And you know you're not crazy. If you know, you know... One thing if you see them on LSD or something. It's a different thing if you see them and you know you're correct. You saw them directly. And then who can tempt you, you know, with anything worldly?
Do you have to be a bodhisattva to be
no,
aware?
No, you don't have to be a bodhisattva.
So what is it precisely that leads to this perception?
Perceive emptiness directly. And the method to perceive emptiness directly is contemplating emptiness in an intellectual way. You can't skip from no training to perceiving emptiness directly. First you perceive it intellectually. You talk about it, you think about it, you get a very good idea about it. And in the highest stages of that, there's a stage called heat, which means you're getting hot. And you will have the experience that you will perceive how things are an illusion. Just before you perceive emptiness directly, you perceive what the students now we're building, okay? The students in the first class know dependent origination. You perceive dependent origination for the first time. You know that this chair is a product of your conceptions and just a picture in your mind. And you see it directly for the first time. And then the next half hour, you go into a state of meditation and you perceive emptiness directly. That is a totally different experience.
So you have to be able to...
You have to have the heat before you get the vision, you know? Yeah. You have to have that training. Of course you have to have that training. It's very difficult to see this thing. If it wasn't difficult to see, you wouldn't be here. Because it is the antidote for this life. It's what stops this life. If it wasn't difficult, you wouldn't be here. We'd be gone. We'd be in a much nicer place, okay? The proof of us not having seen emptiness is that we're here. And before you perceive that, you need much training about it. So we say, in all the Buddhist texts, it says meditation, and before that, contemplation, and before that, study. Classroom hours. I think Rinpoche we counted up now recently, it's like 4,000 hours he taught since he came here. And that I'd say that's about what it takes, something like that. No, it just takes, and it's not just understanding it intellectually the first time. You have to hear it over and over again. It starts to affect your being. And then suddenly one day things start to happen. You cannot do it without learning. You cannot do it without training. It's very difficult to do. It's much harder than running a 3-minute mile or any other understanding Einstein or... It's much more important, and it's much more foreign to our state of mind. So it takes training. So it's not a waste of time to sit here and learn all the fine details. And I would say that without doing that, you probably can't perceive it, unless you had done it in your past life and then, you know, you were very close to doing it. No. Okay. So this is the book. This is I like to call it the onion skin. You know, the Buddha's speech is in the middle and in the center. And then there's the early Indians. Then there's the later Indians. Then there's the early Tibetans. Then there's the later Tibetans. Sometimes there's a 19th century, 20th century Tibetan. And then there's us Americans trying to... You have to go back through the commentaries. You cannot understand this. I swear you cannot understand this. You can't read this. And you can't understand Tsongkhapa. I'll give you some Tsongkhapa. There's some sutra here. You need to go back this way. It's very wonderful. Some Western scholars like to try to skip all those, and it's kind of funny what they come up with. Okay, now we're on to the perfection of wisdom. What is the perfection of wisdom? Any guesses?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
What do you think the perfection of wisdom is? It's very famous. Prajnaparamita, perfection of wisdom.
Does it mean something like going beyond?
That's what the word means, okay? The word that we translate in English as perfection means to go beyond. But that's not what is it?
Understanding the ultimate truth.
Any more?
It's the sixth perfection of a bodhisattva.
Okay, any more guesses? Yeah, no, they're all...
The sixth thing a bodhisattva has to perfect.
Is it omniscience?
Yeah. Okay, do you have to be a Buddha to get it? Is it the knowledge in the Buddhist mind? All partially... I mean, all close, okay? But, no, it's defined as Techen Semyegi Simbe Gone, Toni Musu de Tope, which means, basically, it's the perception of emptiness linked with a desire to help all other living beings.
That's what the perfection of Paramita is.
That's what the perfection of wisdom is. Okay. And that's a precious little knowledge. Okay? You'll hear this word used for the rest of your life in Buddhist magazines and stuff like that. What are they talking about? They don't know, I think. The definition is perceiving emptiness under the influence of love.
Whose definition is that?
The Maitreya's and the Buddha's. Okay. That's a nice thing. You're getting what I teach is not my idea. It's not even a Tibetan's idea. It's not even a Sanskrit author's idea. It's the sutras. It's the Buddha's own speech. You have to turn it up from up there. It's okay. It's kind of cranky, but you'll figure it out.
This definition you're talking about, I'm sorry, this definition you just gave us is the definition that the Buddha gave. Is that what you say?
Sure.
Okay.
It's the perception of emptiness. Okay. It's to see emptiness under the influence of the desire to help all living beings. Why do they say under the influence? Because at that moment, as you're perceiving emptiness, you can't have any other emotion directly. You can't have love in your mind when you're perceiving emptiness. It's such it's a different experience. They call it chula chushapa, water poured into water. The perception you have at that moment is totally different than any perception you've ever had. And at that moment, you can't perceive your friends. You can't even perceive yourself. You can't even think about yourself. And when you come out of it and you try to explain it to other people, you can't. So, but your mind never loses that love. The love is there, and it's in Tibetan, it's called holding your mind. Your mind is imbued. Your mind is soaked with love. You're perceiving emptiness directly. But the whole time, the reason you're doing it, what you want to do when you get out, that whole experience is for other people, for other beings.
Yeah. You're talking about prajnana paramita as opposed to experiencing emptiness without it being linked.
Right. That's the definition of prajnana paramita.
Right. So, you don't mean to say that anyone who perceives emptiness
achieves prajnana paramita? No.
Right. So you're distinguishing between someone else who would perceive emptiness without bodhicitta,
without love,
and prajnana paramita.
Yeah. It's not the perfection of wisdom if you don't have the motivation and the desire to be helping all other people.
What is it?
But that's bodhicitta. Oh, it's just a perception of emptiness. We'll get into it. It's a long story. It's a subject of our text.
Can someone who is a hinayana achieve perfection of wisdom?
So then, they can achieve wisdom.
So, Hinayana predated Mahayana. So, how did it come to pass that the Buddha said this directly, and this is before Mahayana was invented?
Mahayana wasn't invented. The Buddha spoke Mahayana. The Buddha, we'll study that subject during this course. There are three great phases in the Buddha's teaching career, and they're separate. And the first phase was Hinayana. But the perfection of wisdom is Mahayana. Now, can they become an arhat? Can they achieve nirvana without this? Yes. Can they become a Buddha without this? No. And you'd know that if you took the first course. Hopefully. Okay. Perfection of wisdom. The perception of shunyata under the influence of bodhicitta. In the mind, okay, of a bodhisattva, Arya. In the mind of an Arya bodhisattva. Okay, two things there, bodhisattva and Arya. Okay. What does Arya mean? Anybody remember?
Super.
No. What is it? How do you get to be an Arya? It doesn't mean what Hitler said, okay? It was a couple thousand years before that. What does it mean? Oh, yeah.
It's how do you reach Arya? Too here, isn't it? I mean,
by being
a bodhisattva.
Huh? By
having maybe we didn't have. Arya is anyone who's perceived emptiness directly.
How do you write that?
What's the difference? I mean,
we'll go over it.
You're talking about Arhats?
No. Mm-hmm. No. I'll talk about three words, okay? I used to get these confused too. So you're in good company.
The first one is what you said, an Arya bodhisattva?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying that my description of what the perfection of wisdom is, it must be in the mind of an Arya bodhisattva. He has to be an Arya, and he has to be a bodhisattva. What is an Arya and what is a bodhisattva? Okay? An Arya is anyone who has seen emptiness directly in a deep state of meditation. Have you perceived emptiness? You have, tonight. Okay. I said the word emptiness, you had some perception of it. You did not perceive emptiness directly. You have an intellectual perception of emptiness tonight. But you have not perceived it directly, I guess. I can't tell. I don't know. We'll skip the bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is any being who has the genuine desire to become a Buddha to help all other living beings. So can you be one without the other?
Sure.
Yeah, we did talk about that.
Yeah.
Bodhisattva. Oh, okay. Bodhisattva is easier to reach than Arya. Well, it's a long story.
We don't know.
you can reach a desire to help all other living beings and not see emptiness yet. So you can have that love before you have that perception of emptiness. You can also have the opposite happen. You can perceive emptiness first and later move up to Mahayana. So bodhisattva is anyone who has that real desire to help other people. And Arya is anyone who's seen emptiness directly. And Arhat is a person who has reached nirvana.
So isn't it redundant to say that prajnaparamita can only happen in the mind of an Arya bodhisattva
because
you can't be an Arya bodhisattva unless you've perceived
That's true. And unless your mind is imbued with that.
In other words, anybody who... You couldn't experience prajnaparamita unless you were an Arya bodhisattva.
But they have other states of mind that are not that state of mind. Okay?
Michael, how can... the difference between an Arya and an Arhat, what would it be? Because
no, you can perceive emptiness directly.
Yeah.
But it takes it takes a lot of training after that to use that emptiness to stop all your bad thoughts.
Okay.
An Arhat is a person who has stopped permanently his anger, his desire, his jealousy, all those other emotions. He cannot have them anymore. To do that, you must perceive emptiness. You can hold back your anger and your jealousy and desire with all other kinds of methods. And that's what the Dalai Lama was talking about in Arizona. I mean, mainly, you can use a lot of little mental tricks to try to control yourself. But it's only controlling yourself. If you understood emptiness, you would not have those. That's the way to stop them permanently. Stopping them permanently, never getting angry again, is nirvana. It's a nice thing to work for. Okay. What time? Are we doing okay? Okay, 5 minutes. Is that boiling yet? No. I doubt if it's boiling. We have to dump some tea in it. There's some spices in it, but no tea. And I think she has tea on the near the sink there. Eucalyptus, I think we're supposed to hear. Okay.
But why did you say, unless I wrote the wrong definition here, it says one who has seen Arya, one has seen emptiness directly in a deep state of meditation.
Right.
But then you've referred to us as, you know, when we're trying to figure out what emptiness was, is you are an Arya.
No, you've understood emptiness in an intellectual way.
But we're not an Arya then.
You have some idea about what emptiness means because we are talking about it, but you haven't perceived it directly because of that. There's a joke in Tibetan, you know, you do the Kyabdo Senge before class. So did you reach Senge? Did you reach Bodhicitta? Because you recited Bodhicitta? You know,
okay. I think there's an important distinction is always made between an intellectual understanding and the direct perception of Shunyata. Mm-hmm. Mark?
Yeah.
It's quite a big
wait, I'm sorry, then I must misunderstand. We're not an Arya about it.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
He said that we perceive emptiness, but not directly.
It's like, I can talk about, who's a famous person that you've never seen?
Richard Gere.
I can talk about a famous person who you've not met personally. That you've never seen directly.
Yeah.
When I start talking about him, you get a mental picture of him.
Yeah.
In that sense, you understand Richard Gere, but you haven't experienced him directly. When you meet him face to face, that's the direct experience of Richard Gere. Okay. All right, that's the perfection of wisdom. There are three different levels of the perfection of wisdom. And I'll just say it quickly. One is called the path, the perfection of wisdom in the path. That's the perfection of wisdom in the mind of a person who is not yet a Buddha. Okay. He's not perfect yet, but he saw emptiness directly and he has that love.
Tongma?
Yeah, Techen Tongma, Mahayana Tongma. But you don't need to know that. The second kind of present paramita is the one that Laura is talking about. The one in the mind of a Buddha. Okay, a person who sees all things. That's the second kind of perfection of wisdom.
See emptiness and you see all things?
Yeah, at the same time, he sees emptiness directly and he perceives every single thing in the universe. That ever was and ever will be.
So he perceives it all as empty.
And he perceives the thing itself at the same time, which no one else can do. When you perceive directly the emptiness of John, you can't see John at that moment. But his mind is different. He can. He can see every thought in the mind of every being who ever lived and ever will live in one moment.
Is there a name for that? The first one is called path, and this is...
Yeah, this is called result. Okay, it's the perfection of wisdom of the result. That's the one we're trying to get.
And you said he perceives the thing at the same time?
As its emptiness.
As what?
As he perceives its emptiness. And we can't do that.
You're saying he sees the deceptive appearance.
Right. Yeah. He sees the way it looks to us. Mm-hmm. And he sees the way it really is at the same time, which we can't do. We're either seeing one or the other. But it is a long story. You don't need to know that. The final perfection of wisdom is the books about perfection of wisdom. The books. Those three sutras, for example. Those are called the perfection of wisdom, right? They're called the Prajnaparamita Sutras. They are the books about wisdom. Are they the perfection of wisdom, really? Are they really the perfection of wisdom? Are the perfection of wisdom sutras that the Buddha taught, the middle one, the short one, and the long one, are they the perfection of wisdom? Mm-hmm. Who said, mm-hmm? No, they're not. Why not? What's a big, you know, when you're debating, what do you say? Okay, if you think it's perfection of wisdom, then show me the definition of perfection of wisdom. Sure. No, it's easy. There's only two things you need. No, only two things you need. What's the perfection of wisdom? Sure. What's the perfection of wisdom? Only two things. What? You perceive emptiness,
yeah,
and you have this love. Okay. The perception of emptiness under the influence of this unbearable love is
so
perfection of wisdom.
A book.
Yeah, it can't be a book. A book is something you can see and touch.
Oh, I wasn't being that literal-minded.
Yeah,
okay.
The perfection of wisdom is what? Mental or physical?
Mental.
It's mental. It's a mental state. It's like jealousy, right? It's like anger. I mean, it's a mental state. You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. You undergo it. You feel it. You have it in your mind. Okay. So really, the third perfection of wisdom is not the perfection of wisdom. It's a book. Okay. Actually, in Buddhism, we don't say book. We say it's sounds. Because it's really the word that, as the Buddha spoke, it's those sounds that people heard.
Teachings.
I guess what I was getting at when I said that was the fact that the Buddha spoke it, and they were sounds, and the Buddha himself achieved that, was that on some level.
Oh, sure.
In some respects, it was the perfection of wisdom. That was the thing.
It was the perfection of wisdom called the mother.
It's the mother of all teachings.
It's the mother of, well,
Buddha.
That's her point, but it's the mother of all
Buddha.
It's the mother of the Buddha. Okay.
What do you mean, the mother of the Buddha?
It's what produces Buddhas.
Oh, I see.
At the in this verse, in the opening lines of the book, it says, "Kanda yanda de metuna numaguna naso disun ba nendu chande sumetsoshi sanki kini yundera chaksalos." I bow down to what makes Buddhas. Okay. Usually, at the beginning of a book, you bow down to the Buddha or you bow down to some bodhisattva. But this book is special. At the beginning of this book, they bow down to the mother.
What about the father?
Comes later. 6 years. Seriously. Okay. It's the mother. Right? It's the mother of all Buddhas. In fact, what's the name of the Heart Sutra, the real name of the Heart Sutra? It's Prajnaparamita Hridaya Bhagavati, the female Buddha. The word for the Heart Sutra is a feminine. Okay, it's the mother. Wisdom is the mother. Wisdom, the baby of wisdom is the Buddha. Okay, and the Buddha bows down to what made him a Buddha. Okay. That's why it's called the mother. And it's obvious, right? Third path. Third Mahayana path. How do you get to number five? You gotta have number three. Number three is the mother, number five. That's all. Take about a 10-minute break. There's somebody should open up all this stuff. If Anila comes, you should thank her. She really worked hard to clean up the place and all that stuff. Basically, refuge means that
ten minutes late.
This is not. She's in the advanced class. There are three kinds of refuge. What does refuge mean? Refuge means very simply. We're going to talk about it next week. But two things have to be present for refuge. Two things have to be present. You guess. You tell me. What do you think are two things that are necessary for refuge to happen?
Renunciation?
Yeah. We call it being scared. You have to be scared. You have to be frightened. Right? You know, when you run to mommy, that's your first refuge in your life, right? It's because you're scared. It's because something's hurting you. So the first, the first requirement of refuge is something bad, something that you're afraid of. In Buddhism, it's what?
Suffering.
It's suffering. It's the very fact of life. Okay, and we talked about it many times. You can say what you want. You can try to find who you want. But no one is really happy in this life. Everyone is suffering. Relationships fall apart. You get sick. You get old. There's nothing to look forward to. You know? First you can't get a job, then you get the job, then you don't like the job. Right?
Yeah, I haven't started my job yet.
But I bet in 6 weeks you come
back. Oh, no!
Oh, God, I wish I would have found another job.
I feel wrong.
And then even if you like the job, you lose it. The company goes under, it's bought by another, they kick you out, etc. You know, there is no happy ending in this life. Some people realize that at 15, some people realize it when they're 20, some people realize it at 40. Almost everybody who makes it to 60 or 70 realizes it. It's messed up. Okay? Your body itself is a time bomb. It's just waiting for something to go wrong. Dr. Jinden, the Dalai Lama's doctor, says health is an accident. He said that. It's an intemporary balance, the three things that aren't supposed to be balanced. And it'll go out of that. It should go out of whack. And you should get sick and get old. There's no, you have to be crazy not to notice it at a certain point. You have relationships, they always mess up. Your body falls apart. It's not your fault.
Don't listen.
It's the nature of the thing. Yeah. It's the nature of the thing. Even if you have a perfect relationship, one of you dies. And the other one's lonely. Okay. No, that's the only way it can happen. There's no other ending. I mean, tell me another ending. There is no ending.
Buddhist motivational dynamics course.
Yeah. it's lousy. There's no other. I mean, face it. Be frank. You know, be truthful about it. There is no other. Every job you ever get, you will lose. Everything healthy about you will get sick. Everything you love will go away. You know, that's life. That's true. I love Buddhism for that reason. You know, no one can. It's a silent room. No one's saying, but.
The usual comment at this point is, but like, what about a beautiful sunset? Can't you just enjoy, like, nature?
So, what's the second thing you need for refuge?
Faith.
Huh?
Faith.
No.
No?
What happens when you're running to mommy? I mean, two things going on. Fear and...
Protection?
Yeah, you think she can help.
A belief in protection.
You think she has some ability to do something for you. You don't go running to little sister. You go running to mommy because she can fix things.
That's what I mean. There's faith in the idea that it can help.
Yeah, you have to have some kind of shelter, protection. You believe that person or that thing has protection, the power to protect you. So when you get sick, who you call? You call a doctor. The sickness is the pain, and the doctor is the object of refuge. Because you believe he can fix you. And when someone steals something from you or mugs you, you go to the police because you have that bad experience and you have some thing you help can help. You believe that object can help you. When you have a complaint with your landlord, you go to the court because you believe that the judge or the court can help you. And it's a bad experience. So basically, protection or refuge consists of a bad experience and then going to somebody that you believe has the power to help you. Okay. And we're going to talk about the three things that a Buddhist goes to refuge for. So, by the way, I within 30 seconds, I hereby cancel all the refuges of the world. Forget it. You know, I mean, what is there? Who can protect you? You know, nothing. None of the normal things that people think. You know, money can't help you. Howard Hughes, who's that? River Phoenix, right? He's rich. Why didn't he just... Why did he die in front of a nightclub before he gets to 25, 30 years old? What is that? I mean, money can't help you. Health and youth and fame can't help you. Intelligence can't help you, per se. No police can help you, no doctor can help you. I mean, when you're time to die, no doctor can do anything. There is none of the objects, money, emotional comfort of your friends, nothing is can help you. Nothing will help you. There is no refuge in the world. There just is not. That's just in itself. That's a good reason to become a Buddhist. And realizing that is what makes you a Buddhist. Okay. So we say the three jewels: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay. The first refuge is Buddha. The refuge of Buddha, and I'm going to quote from the book. You get to read the back. There's 7 pages in the back. You read the English as your homework. It's part of your homework. That's your reading assignment. It's the only thing to read in this book, okay? So don't worry about it. We don't have a book yet. You guys are the guinea pigs. This book has never been translated. Okay? These books have never been translated.
Oh.
So if you see something that confuses you or you don't like or you have a suggestion, come and talk to me. Say, look, if you expect me to teach students, you know, what's this gibberish here? Can you put that better? That's part of the idea of having this group, is you help translate these books so you can use them later.
Right? So you wrote the book?
Well, we translated it, but we didn't. It's written by a kid.
Oh, I mean the English version.
Yeah, started. Okay, so it says that definition of Buddha jewel is the ultimate place of refuge who has completely satisfied both the needs. He has 2 qualities. He's a real refuge. It's a real protection. And he has satisfied both needs. 2 qualities. He's a real protection, the ultimate protection, and satisfied both needs. Ultimate protection means what? In the text it says he has reached the end of the path. Any form of protection which has not reached the end of the path is not an ultimate protection. He is an ultimate protection. What's his second quality? He satisfied both needs. There's a famous line. It's the opening of the logic book written about 15 centuries ago. And it says, it's about taking refuge in a person who has satisfied both needs. What are both of the needs? Your needs and other people's needs, okay? That's what both the needs means. Everything you need and everything other people needs. Very famous idea in Buddhism. You are working for both, supposedly.
When you say you mean your own.
Yeah, you're trying to get what you yourself need, and you're trying to get what other people need. The Buddha supposedly has gotten everything that everybody needs. He's gotten what he needs, and he's gotten what other people need. Is that true?
Okay.
We have big debates in the monastery. Obviously, he's achieved his own needs. He's got his own needs filled. He's a Buddha. He's enlightened. He has no more problems. He has no more suffering. He has a different kind of body. It looks like diamond. He has no suffering anymore. He lives in a paradise. Permanently. So he has fulfilled his own needs. But what about my needs? My needs are still unfilled, no? That's a big debate in the monastery. The Buddha has filled our needs. That's a very interesting idea.
We just can't see them because of our karmic obscurations.
It's not like that so much as... well, think about it. Cook it. We'll talk about it. Let's talk about it next week. Is it true that the Buddha has filled all your needs the day he became a Buddha? That's the question. But that's the definition of the Buddha. Of the Buddha refuge. Okay, the Buddha jewel. Okay, Buddha by himself is no use to you. Okay, so some guy is perfect. Who cares? If he can't come and teach you, there's no point to it. So the second jewel is Dharma jewel. Dharma means the teachings. the teachings. The Buddha is useless if he doesn't say anything to us in words that we can understand. So Zita said, these are the teachings. There are two kinds of teachings. One is the teachings in the books, and the teachings that the teachers say. And the other teaching is the teaching in people's hearts, in people's minds. Okay. In fact, Asanga's brother, Vasubandhu, we spoke about the two twins. At the end of his great book, he talks about when the teaching will die in the world. He gives the dates. I mean, even the Buddha's teaching is impermanent. He says, on such and such a time, the books will disappear. Such and such a time, no one will ever have these thoughts anymore. And the Buddha's teaching will be dead.
When you say the teachings in people's hearts, you mean they embody the teachings? Or they?
No, I'm about to describe it, okay? There's two types, and you have to know them. And I'll gets to the definition of the Dharma jewel. And it says, the Dharma jewel, what's the difference between Dharma and Dharma jewel? Dharma jewel is the one you're going to for protection. The protection. And it says, the enlightened side of truth, the pure side of truth, as a cessation or as a path. And we have to talk about those words, okay? As a cessation or as a path.
Are you reading from the book?
Yeah, it's in the book and you'll get it. It's on.
I don't have to write what you're saying.
No. You always have. Okay, what does that mean? It means you can divide everything in the world into suffering or the enlightened side of the world. There are four noble truths. We won't go into it, but basically every object in the world is either pain or the way to get out of pain. There's only two choices. On the good side of things, the side that's without pain, there are two kinds. One is a path and one is cessation. Okay. What is a path, Ms. Siegel?
Yeah. About that today.
Yeah. What are the three principal paths?
Renunciation.
Okay. Renunciation. What is renunciation, roughly? You can tell us when you get renunciation. When do you know you have renunciation?
When you're constantly thinking about escaping from samsara.
This kind of life. When you're constantly obsessed with getting out of this lousy kind of life. Okay. It's renunciation. That idea, that thought, is a path. Right? Second path? Good. Which is?
Wanting to free all sentient beings from suffering.
By becoming a Buddha. Okay. And then the third path?
Wisdom.
Yeah. Knowledge of, mainly emptiness. Okay. Those are the three great paths. Those are Dharma. That's what the Dharma jewel is.
The three paths?
Yes. Any path is the Dharma jewel. Okay. Mainly the ones that lead you out of sense. Those three. Those are the Dharma jewel. So, what is the real protection? Is it some guy? Is it the Buddha? Yeah, it's the ideas. That's the real protection. That's the only thing that can really help you. And that makes good sense. You know, the poor people in the world struggling with these beliefs that they have to take refuge in some guy that they'll never see. He can never do anything for them. But he could do everything for them if he wanted to do everything for them. But he doesn't do anything for them and they're in pain. And the guy never comes, or who is he? They don't know, or what? It's not a refuge. Refuge means those paths. To be good, to be moral, is a refuge. It will protect you.
It's not the ideas, it's the state of mind.
Yeah, you can say that. Or the understanding that if you are good, you won't suffer. That's
in the future.
That's a refuge. That's a real refuge. That is the real refuge. The Ten Commandments, if you want to say. Yeah.
So you don't think the deists have that?
Oh, no, they have. They have. But I don't know how many people would say, you know, I bow down and pray to goodness. You know? That's true. That's correct. That's refuge. If you're not good, you won't get refuge. That's the difference. You can't be bad and have a refuge at the same time. Then the refuge doesn't work. Because the refuge is being good.
But a person may think they are good. You know, they even, you know, say, "Oh, I'm very sensitive, and I'm very, you know, I feel so bad when I see people suffering, and then they hurt other people." So,
no, there's we say,
you know what I mean?
No,
how do you?
It's a mixed karma. The desire to help people, and feeling upset about pain of other people, is a goodness, and then acting bad after that is a badness. They're separate things. Separate things. There's a kind of ignorance. In India, there was a religion that believed that you should meditate on reaching heaven and then you should stab yourself with a knife, kill yourself, and that then you go to heaven. The Buddhists believe that from the point of view of the motivation, it's a virtue. From the point of view of the deed, it's a very bad deed to kill yourself. Okay, so this mixed. You have to, in morality, you have to separate things, you know. But no time. Let's go. So that's the first kind of dharma, jewel, is actually those ideas in your mind. We call them path. Path doesn't mean, you know, like Ninth Avenue, thank goodness. It means those ideas can protect you. Alright? And the other kind of dharma is called cessation. What is cessation? Cessation is a very difficult idea. It means when something has stopped permanently in you. That's what cessation means. You get this word in Buddhism, nobody knows what it means, cessation.
It's the Dharma jewel, it's the second part of the
it's
Dharma
It's the second jewel. Half of the Dharma jewel.
Something that has stopped.
Stopped inside you. Anger at your boss.
It's perfect.
It's perfect.
Okay.
No. You perfected the anger at your mom.
The day that you realize that there is that the boss that you're getting angry at is your own problem. You created it. It's your fault, 100%. Your fault. You made him. You created him, and that every second of anger at him is creating a future one. The day that you finally realize that. And then you're not angry anymore, not because you're controlling yourself, but because it's crazy to be angry, because you're gonna meet him again. When you finally realize that, by the way, that's realizing his emptiness. You have a cessation for anger. You cannot get angry again. It's impossible. It's like burning your finger with a match. You know, you stand there and say, "Oh, that's stupid. Now I figured out the fire hurts my finger," and you just won't do it anymore.
Did you say it was a permanent cessation?
Yeah. By the way, they don't have to be permanent. But
no
the best ones are.
Yeah. Something stopped.
It's a long story. All cessations are unchanging. They may end. I can't explain it now.
So just explain cessation.
But isn't that
cessation means stopping a bad quality in you.
Isn't that
permanent?
When you stop all of them permanently, that's nirvana.
Oh, but you can stop them one
yeah.
by one.
Oh, sure, you have to. You have
to. You're
saying
you can stop them temporarily.
Yeah, you can. But that's not a real cessation. I mean,
but
a true cessation.
It's because of wisdom.
Only wisdom can.
We're talking about true cessations, though, aren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Only wisdom can.
So it is permanent.
There's a long story. Generally, you can say it's permanent. Nirvana is permanent. In Nirvana, the cessation is permanent.
True cessations are not permanent.
You can have a cessation that's not permanent. You can have a cessation that ends. But generally, if you think of them as not ending, it's better. But for example, if you reach a point where you don't believe in Santa Claus anymore, that's a cessation of the belief of Santa Claus. Do you see what I'm saying? That's a cessation. Is it a virtue? No. Is it a big deal? No. But you stop believing.
I just sort of assume when you add the
truth
cessation, that you're not talking about things like
Santa Claus.
Cease to believe.
But that is a cessation. It's an ending. It's an ending of an emotion within you.
Yeah.
For example, there are many other kinds. The ending of ignorance is a huge cessation. Anyway, that's the Dhamma jewel. What are you working for? What are you taking refuge in? You know, what's your protection? If you can end anger in your heart, that's protection. You know, doesn't that make sense? I mean, doesn't your instinct tell you, now you're talking something good? You know, they used to say I had to go and bow down 3 times and say, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. I don't know where this guy is. I don't know who's the Sangha. Where's the Dharma, you know? The books are going to help me, you know. What is it? You know, it's the actual attitude and the actual ending of the wrong things inside you because of that attitude. That's the protection. That's what protects you.
Isn't there a need for anger? I mean, if I set fire to your apartment right now, wouldn't it be abnormal if you didn't get angry?
It would be abnormal, but it would be enlightened. We'll talk about it. Basically, if I understood the true causes of why you ever came to burn my house down and why you exist in my life, then no, I wouldn't be angry. It would hurt me, but I wouldn't be angry. It's a long story. You missed the first course. Okay? Sangha. What is the Sangha jewel? Sangha is a very bad, confusing word. There are some Dharma groups that call any kind of group of students Sangha. That's a nice concept, that they're a community. Sangha means coming together. Sangha means coming together. But it's not what Sangha means. Sangha technically means a quorum of monks. But that's at least 5 to do certain rituals. But it's not even that. Even that's not the real Sangha. The real Sangha is any person who's perceived emptiness directly. Is the Sangha jewel. Okay, that's the one who can help you.
With or without bodhicitta?
Yeah.
So any Arya?
Basically, you become... By the way, if you perceive emptiness directly, how many jewels do you become? How many shelters do you become? Yeah, automatically you're 2. You are 2. People are taking refuge to you then. Okay? Because you are Sangha, jewel. You did perceive emptiness directly. And you have Dhamma in your mind. You have the cessation of what? Ignorance. Okay? I mean, not the ultimate cessation of ignorance, but you put a big hole in it. In Buddhism, they say, revere. You ripped it. You tore the fabric of ignorance, of reality.
I was just reading, I don't know where it was. The Sangha was, and I'd never seen it defined this way before, but the Sangha was actually the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Mm-hmm. No mention of monks.
Oh, no, We'll talk about it next week. There's a real Sangha and there's an apparent Sangha. And you'll see it in your reading. By the way, the reading that you're going to be asked to do is very confusing and very difficult. Cook it. It's only, you know, if you take the Tibetan out, it's 3 pages. Meditate on it. Read it over and over again. Think about it. It's very difficult. Okay. I took out the easiest part from the book. It's difficult, especially the first few paragraphs, which we're not even going to talk about right now. And they're very difficult. But just cook it. You know, this is the way you learn. In Buddhism, you don't learn everything at once. You feel uncomfortable. It hurts. Sakyapanita said, Kepa lobe dunadu dewa duna kemisi dewa chuma chapa ye dewa chambi chomiyo. It means... Wise people suffer while they learn. My teacher taught me this first. Wise people suffer while they learn. If you want to be comfortable, forget about becoming wise. People who are attached to small pleasures, don't get big ones. Right. Okay, let me see if I covered all my homework for you guys.
So, Mike, what's the idea of the, inner outer secret refuge? Is that tied into this too? You want to cover it?
We won't cover that. 6 years. All right, last thing. What is an ultimate refuge? And it's defined in the book as any refuge where the journey along the path has reached its final goal. Okay. Ultimate refuge.
Ultimate?
Ultimate protection. Any refuge where the path, what did she say?
Where the journey
along the path has reached its final goal.
The journey itself has reached the goal?
Yeah, I have to say it that way. Why? Because it doesn't refer only to a person. I can't say the person who's reached the final goal.
The journey.
The process.
The process, really. What it means is a Buddha or something about a Buddha. Okay, that's the real shelter. That's the only ultimate shelter. So that's all tonight. Now you're past the Lamrim world, okay? You are now into the first course was the easy one, okay? Now if you really want to learn, this is it. And it's difficult, okay? And it's precise. And it takes some thinking. Okay? Don't give up. Don't think it's not worth it. There are very few people who can go through these books. There are very few Tibetans who can go through these books. But if you go through them, it's incredible. Then when you meditate, something will happen. Because you know precisely what you're doing. So, I repeat. Okay, what are we talking about? Protection. Protection. From what? I mean, what are you afraid of to go to mommy?
Suffering.
Suffering, okay? There's nobody in this room who doesn't have it. I translated for Dr. Dundon many years ago. And he, at the end of the lecture, he said, anybody who's got a medical problem, please see me afterwards. Nobody left. Anybody who has a serious medical problem, see me afterwards. Nobody left. And I was shocked. I said, boy, they look like normal people, but everyone's got something wrong with them. It's suffering. If you're not sick now, you're going to be. Okay. If you're not old now, you will be. If your joints and all your bones don't hurt now, don't worry, it's coming. If you're happy at your job, don't worry about it. Some asshole will come along and ruin your day. I swear, this is the nature of this life. There is no happiness here. On the tip of the needle of this life, there is no pleasure. That's a famous Buddhist thing. There is no happiness. I mean, there are brief times when you say things are going pretty well, and then they collapse again. Okay? Don't worry, it's not your fault. It's the nature of this world. No one's happy, okay? Unless they're a saint or something, unless they are really understanding religion well. The other people, don't worry, no one who looks happy is really happy. Okay? It's not. If you're not understanding these things, if you're not understanding the spiritual things, then you won't be happy. It's impossible. Because of the nature of life, not because of you. And what can help you is only those... Actually, this is the only direct help, is the Dharma. Okay? It's those attitudes in your heart. When you really care for other people, when you really understand the trouble you're in, when you really see that your boss that you hate is coming from you, then that's protection. Then you can stop the suffering. No, there's no other way. You actually have no choice but to go for refuge.
So the Dharma jewel is having the teachings in your heart? Is that the idea?
The real Dharma jewel is the attitudes, the paths, and I gave you three paths. Laura gave you three paths. And the cessations.
In your heart.
Meaning the end of anger in your heart. Yeah. In your mind, right? We say in your mental stream. Whatever you want to say. You'll know it when you get it. That's all. So I'll give you some homework. I don't think I've covered everything on the homework. And you have to do the whole thing. Read the whole thing carefully. I sometimes when I put two or more questions in one question, people answer the first part and don't answer the rest. Please read the whole question, all right? And I went on to the back. I made a rule I wouldn't, but I had to. So that's all. This is due next week. Okay. Your grade is... I think it was 2/3 or 3/4 from the classwork. I'm more concerned about the classwork, what you do every week on a regular basis. And then the final is like 1/4. I'll split this into two. Please be on time, and I'll try to end that. How did we do? Not too good.
10 minutes.
Please come on time, then we'll try to stop on time. And don't, if you feel confused or if it's too much for you, it's a good sign. It means you're learning something. Okay? No, it means if I sat here and said something you already knew, you'd feel quite comfortable and you wouldn't be learning anything. Okay? That's the point.
So to qualify the ultimate refuge, it's any refuge through the process to reach the goal.
Yeah. Why do we have to say process? Because, like, the knowledge in a Buddha's heart... Is not the person who's reached the ultimate goal, yeah, but it is a thing which has reached the ultimate goal.
What is the master
of five?
Third refuge.
Oh, three jewels. Give me the three jewels in Tibet. Oh, it means if there's an asterisk, the Tibetan students have to write it.